Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Animal Studies. Today, I'm speaking to Rob Percival, head of policy at the Soil Association, Britain's leading food and farming charitable organization. In his new book, The Meat Paradox, Rob outlines the history, psychology, and ethics of meat eating. Despite being an omnivore, Rob is deeply sympathetic to the vegan cause. This unique perspective positions him to effectively address meat eaters as one of their own, and makes The Meat Paradox one of the most interesting books on the topic since Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your personal background and what inspired you to write this book.
Certainly. So I work for the Soil Association, which is a UK charity campaigning for healthy and sustainable food and farming. The organisation works right across the food system in quite a practical sense with farmers and land managers to support a transition to organic, agroecological and regenerative farming. And then up the supply chain with food businesses all the way up to national policymakers. And my role is really focused on the diet shift that we need to make a sustainable food system possible. And in this capacity, I focus on political influencing, so working at a Westminster level with the UK government, and on public-facing campaigns, so trying to engage citizens to change their behaviour and put pressure on businesses. And in both those contexts, I found myself at the centre of a heated and polarised debate related to animal consumption, meat consumption. Meat has become a polarizing issue with deeply entrenched camps at either end of the dietary spectrum arguing the cause. And I began to wonder what was driving the divisive nature of the debate. Why was it so polarized? Why was it so emotionally heated? And this led me to a body of science which has been published in the journals of social psychology over the past decade, all falling under the banner of the meat paradox. So looking at the psychological tensions and cognitive forces which skew our relationship with meat. And the book was born from there and took me off in some really unexpected directions.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the meat paradox is and its roots in psychology?
Well, when it comes to animals, the animals we consume, we often say one thing and do another. We claim to care for animal welfare, but it's factory farmed chickens and pigs that make up the bulk of our diet. In the UK, one in three of us claim to be eating less meat. We're all going flexitarian and vegetarian or vegan, or so we say. But consumption data shows that we're not really eating less meat. We're actually eating just as much as we were 10 years ago. And sitting beneath this is a sense of deep moral anxiety. We are inclined to empathize with animals, albeit in an inconsistent manner. And there's a sense of ethical distress that can arise when we perceive that we've contributed towards the harm of an animal, which is intrinsic to animal farming. We kill animals to consume them. And this, psychologists believe, creates a state of cognitive dissonance, of emotional tension. And in the past 10 years, they've begun to map out how we manage that tension, looking at some of the strategies on both a cognitive and cultural level that we enact to navigate the tension, to maintain our status as seemingly empathetic omnivores. And it's revealed some really surprising things about the nature of human perception and the way that society treats animals and thinks about animals.
There's an interesting part of the book where you talk about Veganuary. And Veganuary is this period of time in January where people take a vow to eat vegan. And in this section, you talk about how Veganuary has actually caused a lot of backlash. And why is it that asking people or trying to convince people to go vegan is so offensive for some people?
Well, one of the psychologists who's led some of this research into the meat paradox is called Hank Rothgerber, and he conducted a study which I think is really illuminating. He took a couple of groups of volunteers and he exposed them to two individuals, one individual who ate a gluten-free diet and one who was vegetarian or vegan, gave the participants a whole series of questionnaires to fill out. They didn't really know what they were being tested on, examined on. And those who'd been exposed to a vegan were more likely to denigrate farm animals, downplay their estimation of how mindful and sentient those animals are. And they were also inclined to underestimate their meat consumption. They claimed to eat less meat than the other group, which had been exposed to a gluten-free individual. And they were inclined to go on the tack denigrate the individual who had chosen not to eat meat. And it's a sort of microcosm for a lot of what we see across society, where we're extremely sensitive as meat eaters, as omnivores, to the ethical critique which is embodied in veganism and in vegan individuals, those who choose not to eat meat, because it confronts us with the fact that it is a choice. It's more complicated than that. It's that there are, and we can come onto this, reasons to think that in some cases animals should have a role in the diet, in a carefully caveated sense. But on the whole, it is a choice, and vegans confront us with that choice. And Veganuary has become a sort of flagship annual event, which comes with its own, you know, baggage. It's all glitzy and social media-y and full of celebrities and can be a bit silly, but it really has lodged the vegan cause in the mainstream, and provoked a backlash, which is interesting and I think actually quite concerning.
I think with a lot of the vegan movement or the push towards vegetarianism, there's a lot of emotion behind it, and I think what's interesting about your book is that you focus on a lot of different farmers who do farm animals for meat consumption, but also have similar concerns about the ethics of farming as a vegan might, and also have concerns about the environmental impacts. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of those farmers that you spoke with and how speaking with them and seeing their views, you know, might run counter to certain narratives about farmers' perspectives on eating meat.
Yeah, I think the media has contributed, and social media has contributed to this. This sense that vegans and farmers are in opposing camps, and animal activists and food producers are at odds with each other. And we've got quite a crude narrative as to what each side of the debate cares about. But there are four farmers who feature in the book, and each of them is in a different place. One is an ex-animal farmer. One is a sort of strident pro-ruminant organic farmer. One I discussed, who was the a key figure in the Soil Association, and was a vegetarian animal farmer, so farmed animals but didn't eat meat himself. And one who talked very openly to me about eating his animals and loving his animals, and the kind of tensions and how we navigated those tensions. I think what came through was the sense that firstly, that industrial animal farming is undoubtedly a huge ethical concern, as well as an environmental disaster. Some of these farmers were suggesting that there was another way, there was a more ethical way, there was a role that animals could play in a sustainable food system. But each of them was grappling with the sort of quandary which is at the heart of the book, which is the emotional and psychological toll of killing. And they all went about it in a different way, but they were very open to that conversation. And I think this is one of the great misperceptions that has arisen as the result of this simplified and polarized narrative, the idea that the farmers aren't willing to have this conversation, don't want to acknowledge that there is a conversation even to have around the ethics of meat. But I think if you tee up that conversation in an appropriate manner, if you go about it in the right way, then my experience, certainly working with farmers and alongside farmers, has been that they're very willing to talk about the ethics of meat and have important insights to share.
Yeah, I think there was one portrait of a farmer that you painted about his relationship with a cow that he had named Ned. Mm-hmm. What was that relationship, and what was that experience like talking with this farmer?
So this was Alex, who farms in West Wales, who employs a what they call a calf at heel dairy system. So the calves in the dairy stay with their mother until a natural weaning age. They're not removed, as is commonplace in the dairy industry. And it's sort of small scale and organic and higher welfare. But obviously, in the case of dairy, there are still big ethical questions to ask, even in higher welfare systems. And Alex told me about Ned, who was his favorite calf, the first calf to be born on the farm, and a big character. His mum used to every now and then forget him and leave him sort of stranded in a corner of the farm, and Alex would have to go and carry him back and look after him, and he had a sort of big silly haircut, as far as cows can have a haircut, but he killed him and ate him. He was his favorite animal, and he killed him and he ate him. And I was asking Alex, you know, what he made of that. He said that he loved Ned. How could he kill him and eat him if he loved him? And I think his answer was interesting, because he was very open to the idea that it was an important question, and that some of the rationalizations he offered in response might be sort of a comfort blanket. But he was saying, look, this is the most ecological way of farming, but this is the way of extracting nutrition from this particular piece of fairly unproductive land. I've every confidence that he's had a really good life, and actually I can enjoy his meat after that. And I present this not as a sort of case study in what the right answer is, but in a different sense, as a case study in how complicated we humans are, and how difficult it is to really get to the crux of the psychology and emotional dynamic. I think the idea that the farmers don't care is not true. The idea that farmers don't care for their livestock is obviously not true, but equally it's astonishing that we can care so much and still be at the end of the day killing the creatures we claim we care about.
That example seemed to me a sort of a textbook case of what you discussed earlier in the book as the ancient contract. What is the ancient contract, and how is it this sort of explanation for why we started farming in the first place?
Yeah, well, the book has a sort of cross-cultural dimension. I look at how narratives of meat and rites and rituals related to meat consumption have arisen in diverse cultures, and with a big focus on indigenous hunting cultures and the sorts of stories that they tell. And I contrast those, for want of a better word, with the story and rites and rituals of meat in our culture. And I think that this narrative of an ancient contract is often implicit, but has been given explicit voice by writers such as Michael Pollan in The Omnivore's Dilemma and some philosophers. The idea is that long ago, when animals were first domesticated, we struck a deal. We signed a contract, and the contract placed duties on both parties. We would provide animals with a good life, protection, medical care, a good standard of living, and in exchange they would give us their bodies. They would donate their flesh and materials for our sustenance and use. And this is really the metaphor or the idea that underpins this sort of welfare paradigm, animal welfare paradigm, and which shapes our attitude towards meat in diverse contexts. But I think that it's as I go on to point out in the book, a flawed narrative. I think there's a deep dishonesty to it, and I think and I think what the book tries to do is begin to tell a slightly different story about our relationship with meat, not in the sort of grandiose hope of supplanting this cultural narrative, but in the hope of adding some nuance and seeing its shortcomings.
One of the ways that you add nuance is, instead of just taking this theoretical concept, you give some really concrete examples of indigenous hunting practices. How do certain indigenous communities think about eating meat, and how does that shape their ethical understanding of what it means to eat animals?
Well, in many of these cultures, for all their diversity, stalking, tracking, and killing animals requires that you, to a certain degree, adopt the animal's perspective. You need to hunt a moose. You need to get into the mindset of the moose. To hunt reindeer, you need to project yourself into the body of the reindeer in order to understand how they're thinking, where they're going, and ultimately to kill them. But that very act of projection or of mimetic empathy brings the personhood of the animal into view. So it's common in these cultures for animals to be perceived to be persons. They are animal persons, often scarcely different to human persons. And that poses a significant ethical challenge, because your sustenance then requires that you kill and consume another person. And fears that this killing amounts to something akin to murder, and that eating animals puts one at risk of cannibalism, are common in various of these cultures. So you have to find a way of navigating the risk that you're engaging in murder and cannibalism. And I spend a good deal of time in the book discussing the Tucano, who are an Amazonian hunting society who have evolved a really complex and beautiful cultural narrative related to meat and meat consumption, which helps them make sense of this great dilemma, and I think is very intelligent in the way it places curbs on unnecessary consumption and focuses their mind on the question of necessity. Do I need to kill this animal? Because the crux of their narrative is that if you kill more animals than you need, or if you treat them with disrespect, you will be reborn as the prey animal, as that animal in the next life. So what you're dealing with is a relationship between equals. There's this symmetry of obligations, as it's described. Each species has obligations towards the other, and if you violate those obligations, you'll be taken to be reborn in the flesh and blood of the other.
The example that you give, I think what's something that's very clear about it is that in a non-industrial farming context, you can't hide the fact that it is an animal. It's something that's living that you're consuming. What is the role that industrial farming and just the whole, the whole method of basically hiding the fact that we are eating animals, what impact does that have on people's experience eating meat?
Well, what psychologists and researchers working on the meat paradox have begun to understand is the many ways we detach from the ethical and emotional consequence of what we do. And some of this detachment is literal. You know, we're not allowed onto these big farming units. There are ag gag laws so that whistleblowers can't share what they've seen. Slaughterhouses are out of view and difficult to get onto. So we're cut off from the reality of it. But there are more subtle forms of sort of dissociation and denial as well, which shape our relationship. In our use of language even, and this has been observed for many years, we beef not cows and pork not pigs, and recent research has shown that that when you switch that language around, or you bring the images of the animal into a sort of restaurant setting, it creates these dissonant emotions, and people feel uncomfortable. They're more inclined to empathize with the creature that provided the meat on their plate, and they're more inclined to choose vegetarian dishes. And the more highly processed that meat has been as well, the less empathy we feel. There's a greater degree of empathy evoked by a sort of pig on a spit roast with its head still attached, or a whole chicken, compared to a highly processed burger or chicken nugget. So there are various ways we dissociate the meat on our plate from the animal that provided it. And then there's this sort of tapestry of denial and categorization, through which we downplay our estimation of animal sentience. We typically treat food animals as being less intelligent, less emotionally sensitive than wild animals. And in the moment of consumption, when we're putting the meat in our mouth, if we're quizzed, and researchers have done this, they found cleverer ways of quizzing people without them knowing what's going on. If you ask people the right questions in that moment, they will downplay the degree to which they recognize the animal as a morally irrelevant being. So if you're eating beef, you're more inclined to think the cows are dumb and unimportant, to put it simply. And all this builds on the fact that we're detached from the lives of animals. We don't engage in food production for various reasons, lots of them perfectly valid. But it all adds up to this sort of cloak of denial, which we wrap around ourselves, which enables us as empathetic individuals to participate in this collective edifice of meat consumption, which is almost psychopathic in its disregard for animal life. It's extraordinary, the disconnect between the individual concern that we each have and the collectively held psychopathy is, I think, a really interesting dynamic that's being revealed through this meat paradox research.
What's also pretty shocking about it is the fact that this industrial farming process has a pretty significant impact on the people who are actually involved in the meat production. And there's some pretty startling evidence that you lay out that post-traumatic stress disorder is like a very common experience for people that are involved in this process. I know you, in the book, you discuss your own experiences being in industrial farming facilities and talking to these people. What was your experience with that?
Yeah, so that there is evidence that slaughterhouse workers are susceptible to various forms of emotional trauma and post-traumatic stress. I think there's much more research needed before we know how prevalent these issues are. But the prevalence isn't necessarily the interesting part. It's the potential for trauma that I think is revealing. And in some of these big industrial units, you can clearly see that it's a dangerous and disturbing environment to work in. The production line is high speed, and it's repetitive, and it's a physically dangerous environment. But even in smaller scale facilities, there is a risk of emotional harm linked to the fact that the work involves killing and killing other sentient beings, killing other persons. And we can't help but perceive sometimes that animals are persons, even if we try to deny it, causes distress on a really fundamental level. And I experienced this in a very sort of minor way, but still a hugely moving way in a slaughter facility that I visited, where there was a cow coming through, and I was in that moment, I was quite closely involved in the process and in close proximity, and the act of killing struck me as an act of murder. That was the only word I could find to describe this, and it was a catalyst for a lot of the subsequent events in the book. And I go on to explain in the book, looking at our evolutionary history and cognitive neuroscience, why it is that animals impress upon us as persons, and why it is that even if our cultural narrative denies them moral value, we sometimes can't help but perceive them to be persons on a similar moral plane to humans. And I trace that back into the deep past and some events that happened sometime around the sort of origin of our species.
Yeah, can you talk about that actually? There's an interesting section where you talk about how before humans had speech, a lot of the ways that they probably communicated was through mimicry of animal behaviors. What was that like, and what was that sort of role of animal behaviors in the shaping of our communication?
So one of the questions I was keen to explore in the book was when did all this happen? At what point in our evolutionary history did eating meat, killing other animals, become ethically or emotionally complicated? If you look at other species, lions or bears, you don't see the same sense of tension or distress, at least not in any visible sense that we can perceive. And in an evolutionary context, it kind of doesn't make any sense. If you need to kill to survive, then it doesn't make sense for you to evolve this emotional response, which suggests that you shouldn't. So I wanted to trace that back. The earliest evidence of this tension, I think, arises in our species at least 40,000 years ago, when we first start seeing various bits of ritual and art and image making. But I look back much further than this at the evolution of early human species and the role, as has been explained by archaeologists such as Stephen Meathan, the role that mimesis and mimicry played in early human communication. Prior to language, we needed to find a way to communicate about the natural world. There's a good body of evidence which suggests we did this by sort of gestural communication, enacting the scenes and animals around us. And I trace that animal mimesis through to the sort of beginning of modern human empathy, showing that there is a line that traces through. We had spent millions of years bending our bodies into animal forms and imitating their cries and dancing as animals, and all of this primed us when modern human empathy emerged to extend that empathy very readily and directly to other animals. This is the point at which we started enacting the sort of more complex mimesis and perspective taking that we see in modern indigenous hunters. And it was at this point, I think, that the meat paradox emerged, that we first started to feel the sense of deep ethical conflict associated with killing.
So just to quickly go back to industrial farming practices, I think a major way that myself and a lot of people were first exposed to vegan or vegetarian talking points was through documentaries that basically make the case that eating meat is unnatural, and that, you know, that our ancestors didn't eat meat, things that PETA might put out of, you know, really horrific, terrifying images of industrial farming processes. And I think you take a very interesting perspective on this tactic. Would you say that you're critical of this approach, that you think that it actually sort of communicates the wrong message? What's the issue or what's the benefit of this approach to vegetarian or vegan activism?
So the book is largely concerned with the psychology of meat eating and the various strategies that we as omnivores or meat eaters employ to avoid the ethical question, to look away and deny the moral implications of our behavior. But at the other end of the spectrum, I also look at how those who have made that ethical commitment might be moved by a sort of inverse set of psychological pressures to retell the story of meat, to deny that meat was ever a valuable part of our diets, to deny that it has any nutritional contribution to make, to deny that animals could possibly be part of a sustainable farming system. And we see all this in certain strands of vegan and animal rights advocacy. It's not in all of it. The vegan movement is multifaceted, and I think most of the messages that come out are perfectly reasonable. But there are these strands that deny that that we should, in any circumstances, be eating animal foods, that associate animal food consumption excessively with sort of adverse health outcomes and cancer, over-interpreting the evidence, shall we say, to put it politely, or misrepresenting the evidence. And I think that the reality is far more interesting. Of course, we don't need industrial animal farming, but there are very good reasons to include animals in organic or regenerative or agroecological farming systems. They can play a positive role on the land. There are certain population groups that are more at risk of nutritional deficiencies in a fully plant-based scenario. I'm thinking of pregnant women and infants and so on. And there are around the world many people living in food insecurity who would benefit from eating more animal foods. Now, none of this is an argument for the status quo, and none of it, I think, actually offers closure on the ethical side either. But it does suggest that there is an interesting tension to navigate here. There are good reasons in a nutritional and ecological sense to eat animals in a carefully caveated context. But at the same time, that consumption might still involve murder. It might still involve this act of grave ethical concern, which when enacted, even if the act is necessary, might have psychological and emotional consequences that need to be handled. And it's that tension between necessity and murder, as I frame it, which I think is the crux of the meat paradox.
Would it be right to say that you're not trying to convince people to, you know, fully remove meat or meat products from their diet, just encouraging people to radically reduce for two reasons, for environmental reasons and then also for health reasons? And there's a particular diet that you discuss in it. It's the Eat Lancet diet. It was a study done. I was wondering if you could talk about this diet, this study that was done, and then some of the responses and backlash to not just the suggestion that people should go vegan or vegetarian, but the suggestion that people should just reduce their meat consumption a little.
Yeah, so I mean, the book actually isn't trying to persuade anyone to do anything specific with their diet. It doesn't. It's not advocating for a single solution. It's more interested in prying open the debate and revealing the psychological complexity of it than with nailing down what the exact answer is. But it does present evidence that that if we adopted a sustainable farming system along a variety of lines, but primarily along this sort of regenerative or agroecological line, there would simply be much less meat to go around. If you shared it around equitably, it would involve a significant drop in per capita consumption, average per capita consumption among high consuming nations like the UK and the US. Many people would be eating more in this sort of hypothesized scenario, but most of us would be eating much less. And there's a really compelling body of evidence from a variety of studies, all of which are asking slightly different questions, that this is true. There's really no scenario where we can continue to eat as we are today and expect to have a livable planet. And the Eat Lancet report was one of these studies which went about the question in a quite idiosyncratic way and came up with this hypothesized diet. And there's lots wrong with the report. There are many areas in which their modeling or assumptions could be challenged. But what was striking was the degree to which it was dismissed as a sort of vegan conspiracy, simply because it said eat less meat, or it said many of us should eat less meat. There were high profile food writers and figures in the food movement who launched quite personal attacks on the report authors, who dismissed them as vegans and vegetarians, as though that was some sort of incriminating, status of bias just by being a vegetarian, you're no longer a good scientist, they were insinuating. And it created this quite bizarre sort of milkshake of myth and hyperbole and misinformation, which is still frothing around social media. The words "Eat Lancet" can prompt all sorts of excitable responses, mostly for spurious reasons.
Something that we haven't discussed yet, but it is a very significant part of your book, is some of the ethical questions. You talk about Peter Singer, who's arguably the most famous ethicist when it comes to the animal rights movement, but you also discuss phenomenologists like Emmanuel Levinas. And what role do these sort of ethical questions or these ethical framings bear on how you consider the meat paradox?
The key distinction I was trying to draw out in referring to those two philosophers that you just named was that between an approach such as Peter Singer's, which is trying to establish a framework within which you establish whether an action is right and wrong. There are writers who have and philosophers who have taken on the meat question and gone about it in that way. They construct a rational argument, they try and lead you through the argument, they try and take you from A to B to C and onto their conclusion, whether that's, you know, eat better meat or eat no meat, whatever it is. And that's not really what the book is about. The book is about our ethical experience. What happens when we stand before an animal and take their life? What emotions does that evoke, and what's the underlying psychology that shapes that experience? And in particular, in the sort of face-to-face encounter, embodied encounters. And the key point that I am aspiring to in making that distinction is that it's not a purely rational issue. It's not something that we can settle solely by argumentation, because we are complicated creatures and we're possessed of this ancient and convoluted physiology and psychology, which has its own story, which is shaping the meat debate today in profound ways. So I warn readers early on in the book that they're not going to get a clear and cohesive argument here. They're just going to be taken into the complexity and emotional depth of the issue, or at least that's my ambition.
So obviously the book just came out, so I'm, you know, there's still time for people to react to it, but have there been any interesting praise or criticism that you've received from the book, or just from people that you know?
Well, it's really early days. Yeah, as you say, the book's only been out a week or so, and it's been positively reviewed in the UK, in the Financial Times, in the Sunday Times, two quite different but striking reviews in how supportive they were of the book's sort of central ambition of delving into nuance and complexity and not necessarily taking sides. I think there will be pushback from folk at both ends of the dietary spectrum. I think if you write a book that suggests that animal consumption might be beneficial or even necessary in some contexts, then that's going to be controversial. And my motivations as an author are going to be questioned. Is this just one big argument to try and justify meat consumption and rationalize this this choice that we make? So I expect there'll be some pushback around that end, and I look forward to that conversation. And at the other end, there'll be those who suspect I'm a closet vegan and I'm just adopting a pretense at omnivory in order to try and undermine meat eating and livestock farming and so on. And I've been called a pretend omnivore, a closet vegan many times, but by those who are in that kind of strident pro meat camp. So I have some experience of sitting in between the warring factions. So we'll see what comes.
You position yourself in the middle. And I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, you're still in the end of the day advocating for I don't want to say advocating. No, you still are questioning whether or not the amount of meat we consume is a good thing. So, you know, on that end, you make very powerful arguments. And I think, I really do think that the way in which you profile farmers is interesting, because I frequently feel that in the debate, the people actually involved in meat production or organic meat production are left out. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, why you chose to highlight farmers so much, and maybe a little bit about some of the work that you do outside of writing.
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, I work for an organization that employs farmers. My boss is a celebrated pig farmer, organic pig farmer, and on a day-to-day basis, I work with farmers. So there, I guess it was, I'm not sure how deliberate it was that I profiled farmers in the book. I'm just surrounded by them and deeply impressed by the varying insights and different perspectives that they bring to the debate. They're a fascinating and diverse bunch. And I think that their voice needs to be heard. It's a really difficult situation at the moment in the UK in food and farming, in our sort of post-Brexit context, climate and nature crises escalating. Retailers have broken the supply chain in such a way that farmers are struggling to make ends meet, and our government signing these irresponsible trade deals. So the many of the more sort of philosophical questions that I approach in the book will seem fanciful or detached from reality for many farmers and those who are working the land and facing these more immediate challenges. But I think they need to be asked. I think if we're to address the ecological crisis, we need to see significant changes in our farming system across this decade, huge changes in our diets. And that, I think, provides an opportunity to ask more fundamental questions about the role that animals should play and the commodification of animal life, which at least in principle, most people, I think, agree is an undesirable thing. But it's a really difficult question. How do you go about decommodifying animal life? If we think that animals might have a role on the land and in our diets, albeit a very different one today, then what does it look like to respect them and value them primarily for their ecological contribution and individual dignity and not just as providers of meat? And what sort of lives should they lead? And how do we unpick the kind of tapestry of denial that we've wrapped around ourselves and question the presumptions of sort of the animal welfare paradigm and think more broadly and deeply about what that relationship should be? So the book doesn't, as I've alluded to, doesn't propose to have answers to all these big questions, but it does at least set up a slightly different conversation, I think, and one in which farmers should be central.
So obviously, for anyone who's listening to this, I imagine that, you know, anyone who's made it this far is probably a person who, if they're not a vegetarian, vegan, or someone interested or someone who is that, they're at least interested in vegetarianism or veganism. Are there any, you know, documentaries or books that you would warn people against? And on the other hand, anything that you would recommend that people check out?
I mean, in a broad sense, I think there are there's lots of good writing that's been done about the positive role that the animals can play in organic and regenerative farming systems, and in an ecological sense, I think there's lots to be learned from those books. But I'd warn anyone away from books which indulge in just taking cheap shots at vegans, portraying them in a sort of as a caricature, as silly, uneducated people who don't know what's going on, or who deny that the veganism is motivated fundamentally by care and concern for animals and the environment. So I'm going to refrain from naming names, but there are high profile books and films out there which I think fall into that category. And at the other end of the spectrum, if people are watching vegan documentaries and animal rights documentaries, I think I think that there's a lot going for those, and there are significant causes for ethical concern, obviously with sort of factory farming, but even with higher welfare farming and the moral complexity of killing an animal, I think those ethical questions need to be asked and poor practice needs to be exposed. But when those books and films stray into portraying meat as toxic waste and animal foods as asbestos and carcinogenic junk, without acknowledging the broader nuance, then you know you're in either in a sort of a propaganda exercise, or the authors and producers have succumbed to this complex psychology and are rewriting the world as it is to align with their ethical vision. Again, I won't name them, but there are lots of books out there which fall into that, and films which fall into that category. So I hope what this book will do, The Meat Paradox, is help people see through some of that and read between the lines and recognize the value in both sides of the argument and also the denial that can fall upon us from either side.
Do you have plans for the future to write anything else? To further your discussion in The Meat Paradox?
Yeah, I mean, it's early days. I'm planning the follow-up book now. I'm working on the proposal. It's it's sort of a sequel, but sort of off in a different direction. But it it's looking at de-extinction and the mammoth and genetic technologies, biotechnologies, and retelling the story of domestication and the coming shift towards designed animals and human animal chimeras and so on. So but we're a couple of years off. I think that's seeing the light of day.
Wow, yeah, that's definitely different but really interesting. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I really recommend this book. I think it's one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time, and it's also very, very beautifully written too. So, thank you so much, Rob.
Cheers.